The following recording may contain explicit language. I can't get more explicit than may. Let's just say it may. It's Wednesday, January 29th, 2020, from Slate. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. And Bernie Sanders could very well win Iowa. It could happen. When I hear his Brooklyn lilt, I think of soybeans. When I hear him talking about being a Jew, but mostly an atheist, but kind of a Jew, I hear Heartland. But I'm telling you, as are the polls, as is 538, as did Jon Favreau, Bernie Sanders is, if not the favorite, then the co-favorite, but probably the favorite. Now, the Jon Favreau in question is not the director of Swingers, Elf, and Iron Man. He's the Pod Save America host, the former Obama staffer. I interviewed him yesterday. That interview will air soon. And we didn't, in that interview, talk about who will win or predictions or forecasts. But, you know, on the way out, we did get to talking about that. It wasn't off the record or anything. No one brought out a blank map for anyone to fill out. But he did say, I gotta tell you, what's going on with Bernie in Iowa reminds me a lot of us in 2008. Oh, you mean the last minute momentum on the way to a victory? And he said, yeah, that's what he meant. You know, that's unscientific, but it's also pretty persuasive. So if Bernie wins Iowa, what does that mean? I have no special insight. You all read the same prognoses I do, that winning there would be proof of concept, and it will power him to certainly win New Hampshire, which he won by a lot last time. Sanders is already a big favorite in New Hampshire, according to 538. And if you read all the people saying, well, then the Democratic establishment won't like it, they will shiv him. You probably read all the other pieces saying, no, they won't shiv him because they're Democrats and they don't know where they even keep the shivs. And then you read all the backlash to the counter backlash pieces saying, I don't know if they'll shiv him. They're worried about a reshiving. The Sanderistas will maybe sit shiva. There's all that out there. And I, again, have no special insight, no more than you. But I do have one insight, and it's this. There is a belief that more exposure of voters to Bernie Sanders, his actual thoughts and actual policy prescriptions, will serve to dissuade many voters from his side. If only voters knew his actual sentiments, his actual policies, they will not back him. This is my insight. I am deeply dubious of this claim. I perhaps make this claim. I mean, on the show, you will hear me say, do you know that Bernie Sanders believes in abolishing ICE? Or do you know that Bernie Sanders favors national rent control, which is kind of a nightmare, given that on the local level, it clearly inflates housing prices? So I don't like those policy stances, but put that to the side. I'm talking about what will the effect be once people learn them. And there are a lot of people who will tell you it will turn voters off. But the people who say that already know the policy stances and are usually very oriented by policy stances. I say the power of policy to disqualify a candidate is a myth held by the high-minded, but it is not how politics, especially presidential politics, works. In America, it seems to me during my lifetime, we have sought out, as presidential candidates, avatars, heroes, somewhat empty vessels to pour our hopes and aspirations in, but to some extent, very clear, almost caricatures. If Bernie is to be undone, it will be because he fails to measure up to whatever Democratic voters define as their need for a champion. Here's Norman Mailer on America's need for a hero as a leader. It was a hero America needed, a hero central to his time, a man whose personality might suggest contradiction and mysteries, which could be reached into the alienated circuits of the underground, because only a hero can capture the secret imagination of a people, and so be good for the vitality of his nation. A hero embodies the fantasy, and so allows each private mind the liberty to consider its fantasy and find a way to grow. Norman Mailer, who said simply America was the land where people still believed in heroes. So this is why I say, if Bernie is to be undone, it won't be on policy grounds. It won't be because of his actual positions. It will be because the fantasies and possibilities he embodies will be found wanting when compared to those of his rivals. The question is, not if Joe Biden has the right stance, or if Elizabeth Warren has the right stance, or if Pete Buttigieg says things that voters agree with in terms of where he'll take policy. The question is, do we endorse Joe Biden's fantasy, which is one of restoration, Pete Buttigieg's fantasy, which is one of youthful uplift, Elizabeth Warren's fantasy, which is sort of a heroic cleaning of the Aegean stables, or Bernie's fantasy of revolution. The race will be won by how voters conceive of and feel about the moment and how any candidate matches up to their conception of what the moment demands. Or maybe superdelegates and like 15% thresholds in California. That's possible. On the show today, it is the first day of Q&A. Or is it Q&Yay? No, it's not. It's definitely not. I watch most of it. But first, you know I'm a math guy. I love me some sums. But Matt Parker, an Australian / Englishman, loves to plumb the depths of the mathematical to find the quizzical, the radical, and the climactical. Okay, I'm getting ungrammatical. Matt Parker, author of Humble Pie, up next. The Defender is a beautiful car, but beauty is, of course, sometimes only skin deep. Not with the Defender. Let's talk about the interior. It's robust, built with integrity. Yes, it's designed iconically, the exterior. That's what compelled me. My neighbor Jay says, Mike, you see what's on the block? It's a Defender. And I look down the block, and indeed there is. And me and Jay the neighbor and Michelle, we gather around the Defender. We peer in the window. I have to say, I don't want to make this a little too tawdry, but we lust, or perhaps we gvel. To drive the Defender is to explore with greater confidence. We looked at the cargo capacity, more room for the gear. There's really a wide range of adventures. The Defender family features the two-door Defender 90, the Defender 110, and the Defender 130, which seats up to 8. Push what's possible with a vehicle made to go further. The Defender 110. Learn more at LandRoverUSA.com/Defender. A pretty good, let's say 80% free throw shooter goes to the line. He's fouled shooting a three-pointer, meaning he gets 3 free throws, and he makes 2 and misses 1. And the announcer will say, wow, an 80% free throw shooter missing one of those free throws. How often does that happen? And the answer is about half the time, because people don't understand math, even basketball announcers. And 0.8 times 0.8 times 0.8, it's just slightly over half the time. Well, that's in the context of basketball. What about in the context of evacuating a theater or running a Swiss railway? Humble Pie, When Math Goes Wrong in the Real World, is written by Matt Parker, who was, you might know him as the numbers ninja from the BBC. or not. Anyway, this was a great book. It was a lot of fun. Welcome, Matt.
Great to be here, Mike.
The book's numbered backwards.
Yes.
Or it's not. Maybe we just expect books to be numbered forwards.
Yeah, people say your book, the numbering is in a weird order. I'm like, no, it's not. It's perfect. Well, every number is next to the correct numbers.
That's right.
It just starts at 314 and then counts down one a page.
It's perhaps a little more useful because when we open books, we open to the first page and that tells you how many pages
there
are in a book.
Exactly how much you've got. You know how many are left.
Yeah.
I was considering.
Every book starts with 1. What's that tell you?
And my last book started with 0, which I enjoyed immensely because every other book, if you open it up, it's always odd numbered pages on the right, even on the left. But I started at 0, other way around. And so for this book, Humble Pie, I was like, what can I do that's better? And I thought, you know, I thought I could have like the percentage of the book remaining at the bottom.
That's very
good. Like, no. And so I went for this countdown. And I was particularly pleased because I've got loads of stories where computer systems keep track of time by counting down from some large number. And when they hit 0, they crash. And so there's everything from like,
and sometimes
you know,
so do F-22s.
Exactly.
Yes.
And so a lot of aircraft, these sorts of things. I thought, you know, wouldn't it be great if I could make my book crash the same way? It took a lot of emails with the publishers who they were more open to it than I expected. And so it will count down. It hits 0. And then the page numbers crash right at the end of the book.
So what about the Hebrew language version of the book? How's that work?
No, I don't. We haven't done that one yet. So my previous books had a Hebrew translation. I'm really curious to know what we can do. Like, do we leave them as they are? I don't know. We'll find out.
People who read books in Hebrew, which is probably a very small number of people, will probably think, oh, this is just a mistake in the same way that all the books we read are not really suited to our way of reading a book.
Exactly. And you may have noticed, I had to put a warning at the beginning of the book because the publishers were like, okay, look, you can have your ridiculous backwards numbers, but we don't want people complaining and like bringing it back going, I got a misprint. And so I had to put a warning asking the reader to not return it.
What is your background? I mean, I like that you're obviously very good at math and you're interested in math, but did you do math, or as your people would say, maths for a living?
Yes. Well, I studied mathematics or maths. Well, actually, I studied in Australia, so that's maths. I then moved to the UK. Actually, I started in Australia as a high school math or maths teacher, as the case is there. And I taught teenagers maths for a year in Australia and then 3 years in London, in England. And towards the end of that, I was starting to get into performance. I was doing stand-up comedy. And I was thinking, I'd like to reach a wider audience with math excitement. And so I then went from being a regular math teacher, which I miss. Like, it's hard work, but it's good fun. And now I have the joy of traveling around and doing all sorts of things to get people excited about math.
So the book is chock-a-block of interesting, quirky, eye-opening, perhaps counterintuitive examples of math gone wrong, math that you might not understand or might not get at first blanch. But if you could tell me a couple of these, I don't know, take Swiss railways or Kansas City disasters or toy giveaways, take any of these examples and then tell me what larger point they illustrate.
Yeah, no, it's a really good point. And that's a good sweep of stories you've done. So the Kansas City story is interesting because this is one of the situations where a math mistake had very serious consequences. So over 100 people died because of a math mistake. And I had to be careful when I was writing the book because I wanted it to use it as an excuse to look at how much math we have in our modern society. But when math goes wrong in engineering and aviation and medicine, and people die. And yes. So I had to be very careful to tell these stories in a sensitive way and to not overload the reader because technically I was employed to write a comedy book about math. Yes. And so if every second story was like, and then everybody died, publishers would be very upset. So I tried to have some fun ones and some serious ones. So the serious one with like the hotel is they were building these walkways. This was in the 1980s. And in like kind of the big atrium lobby of this hotel, they wanted to have two walkways, one at about the fourth floor level and one about the second floor level. And the original design were these very long kind of rods, very long bolts would come down from the ceiling all the way down through the top walkway and then keep going down and then stop at the bottom walkway. And both walkways would be kind of bolted onto these long bolts. It'd be like a nut. However, when they were building it, they're like, oh my goodness, so much work. Like, it's very difficult working with a rod that long. Mm-hmm. And I get annoyed winding a nut a little way up an IKEA bolt or something, right? But doing this all the way up, they're like, oh, that's ridiculous. And they were like, you know what, let's change it. And so what they did was they cut the bolts and they had one bolt from the ceiling to the top walkway and then that stopped and like a little nut to hold it in place. And then a new bolt would start and then descend all the way down, joining the top walkway to the bottom walkway. And the problem was they didn't redo the math. And with modern engineering, we are well beyond what we can do intuitively. Like humans, we can't just look at a building and eyeball it and go, yeah, that'll work, right? Yeah. We got to run the numbers.
Right.
So back in the day, you'd use huge bits of stone. You'd look at it and go, yep, that's solid. Whereas now, you got to do the numbers every time. And they changed it without double-checking the calculations.
So how would the shorter bolts result in, without getting too weedsy, but yeah, how would it result in a structural flaw?
So what happened was previously, if there was just one long bolt, each nut was holding up just the walkway it was underneath and attached to. Whereas now the entire weight of the lower walkway was attached to the top walkway, and then that was attached to the bolt. So it's the difference between having like two people abseiling down the same rope, one after the other, versus the bottom person's hanging on to the top person who's then hanging onto the rope. They're now holding everyone's weight. So now the top walkway was not only holding up its own mass, holding up the mass underneath, and the bolts one day when there were too many people on there tore through and 114 people died in the collapse. And you're like, wow, all of that because when they changed the design, they didn't double check the numbers.
Yeah. Now tell me, and say if I'm wrong, not to be nice to the host, but is this an example of the difference between geometric progression and what would the opposite of that be?
Arithmetic progression. That's back to perceiving standard, like same sized increases, which would be an arithmetic progression,
yes,
versus geometric progression, which is where you're going up by multiples.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the one where, as humans, we perceive things geometrically as such. However, in this case, this was just, they didn't double check the forces. They just didn't stop to think, now they've doubled the forces through this one bolt by redoing the calculations.
So do you think you are a comedy guy and a math guy, and you use a lot of puns and wordplay in the book. Do you think puns have a mathematical element to them?
I think a lot of comedy has a mathematical element to it. Puns particularly so. So comedy in general attracts people who are quite nerdy. I think a lot of comedians are closet nerds because the ability to, let's say, stand up, to perform to an audience, while you're talking, you're also thinking about all the other things, material you could be doing. You're responding to what the audience is doing. Your routine is almost like a flow chart, and you've got to have quite a logical brain to execute that and to be able to revise it afterwards and then make changes based on the feedback. And so it's quite a, not an academic thing, but to be a comedian, you've got to have a little bit of that edge to you. Puns take that to another level because you're looking for unexpected connections. And while most people remember math from school as being boring exercises, the beauty of math and a lot of science is the unexpected connections. You suddenly go, oh, wait, this thing over here is linked to this other seemingly unrelated thing because of some deeper logic that unites the two. And that is the thrill of doing math, is solving problems, finding those links. And writing a pun, I think, is a very similar process. You're finding unrelated things, and suddenly you find this fantastic link between them, and you get that same kind of satisfying result that you get in math.
Recently, we just completed a decade. Only if you look at it technically, it wasn't a decade, because years don't start at zero. But where are you on this? Because if you came before me, and I've interviewed people who are language experts, there is this descriptivist, prescriptivist tension, and the descriptivist will say language is just meant to describe things, and if everyone agrees on it, we agree on it. So maybe decade would fall in that realm, but mathematically, a 10 is 10, and 1 and 0 to 1 is either a year or not a year.
I've not ever heard the coming at it from the language point of view. I might be a descriptivist decader. So in a nutshell, the reason people get upset about the decade is there was no year zero.
Sure.
So when we backdated the calendar, we started at one.
Yeah.
And so the first decade technically was the year 1 AD through to 10 AD. And then the next one was 11 to 20 and all the way up. And when we had the millennium, there were a bunch of people going, no, I refused. I'm not going to party like it's 1999. I'm going to wait until it's, 2001 is when it changes. Now, I have two problems with that. One is, and I think I agree with some of your language people here, we've now decided what the word decade means.
Yeah.
And the 20s, which we're now in, are named that because it's all the numbers that start with 20. And so I'm totally on board for that. And I find it a bit weird that because when in the mid-first millennium, we were backdating a calendar, because no one who was alive at the time
knew
it was 1 AD.
When you said there was no year zero, at the time, there definitely wasn't a year zero.
Or a one, just, or anything,
who was
right?
It, Pope Gregory just, and
yeah, Greg was like, Greg came even later when he was shifting the calendar around. And yeah, but it's always been backdated and artificial anyway. And since then, we've gone, look, this is a mess. We got to fix it. We should have had a year zero because in theory, it went from, counting down, 3 BC, 2 BC, 1 BC, no zero, and then 1 AD. And we're missing a zero. And so the International Standards Organization rolled in and went, right, we got to fix this. So from now on, we're going to call 1 BC zero, and then we're going to call 2 BC, the year negative one, and then 3 BC, negative two. So going backwards, it's a bit off. You're off by one in terms of the BC or the BCE number and the official year number, but it fixes everything afterwards. And so if you go off the ISO, which I do, because they're the international body who decide these things, when they rolled out this standardization, they basically said, we have had a zero. The first decade went from 1 BC to 9 AD. The next decade went from 10 to 19, which means now we're fine because it means the last decade went from 2010 to 2019.
Yeah.
And we have now started a new decade.
Nice.
So only the most extreme pedants who have gone out on their own and they want to stick to this old system and they're not prepared to. I mean, it's been a couple of decades now the ISO have updated this, right? Only
well,
if you
actually,
really want to argue.
It's been 1.9 decades.
Well, see, exactly. Exactly.
So if there was one fairly simple concept that you could educate the public on, you had, 5, 10 minutes, not too long, and get them to understand and grasp, what would it be?
It would probably be that a trillion is a lot bigger than a million. I know we keep coming
back
to this.
It's a thousand
times, right?
And so a thousand.
And everyone's like, the increase from a million to a billion is like, oh yeah, okay. And then people think it's about the same again to a trillion. It's not. And so the difference between a billion and a trillion is about a trillion, like a billion.
Right. The
billion is gone. It's 0.1% of a trillion, right? And so, and the difference between a billion and a million is a billion. And so each one dwarfs the previous ones. And so if—
what you're saying is a million is a millionth of a trillion.
Yes, exactly. Yes, it's 1 million. Like, by the time you get to a trillion, when you see these budgets and you're like, you know, the budget or the debt or the cost of this war or whatever is on the order of trillions, and people are like, yeah, I know, because they spent a million on this. And you're like, well, no, that's like 0.00001. But like, it's just, oh, goodness. And so, and I'll often see, it's often budgets I see this in. You'll see a breakdown of some budget, which is either in the millions or the billions, and then the people are quibbling or like, oh, they wasted. And they'll be like, I can't believe they spent a million on this and a million on that and 1,000 on this. And you're like, whoa, what? One of those is not like the others, right?
Right. But wait, is there something where in Britain the trillion concept doesn't really exist in widespread use?
Oh, it's now pretty much the same.
Because things have gotten big.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, stuff budgets, got big. Yeah. No, for a long time, there's like the traditional units where it, because the names are weird, because a billion is when you've got 9 zeros or three lots of three, but then a trillion is when you've got 4 lots of 3 and everything's off by 1.
Right.
And that used to be old school, you'd have a 1,000 and then a million and then something like a milliard and then you'd have a billion. So a billion was what we'd now call a trillion, but thank goodness now everyone's agreed, apart from people who want to argue on the internet, that we just go a million, billion, trillion, quadrillion, and so on.
Yes. My big change is, one is not technically math, but get the hell out of here with not adjusted for inflation figures. Just stop wasting my time. And the second one is, I think it would be great if we inherently would use average when we wanted to use average and use median when that was a lot better.
Yeah, and it's true. I mean, I like the inflation adjusted. Like when people say this film made more money than any other, you're like, well, hang on, you've not inflation adjusted,
yeah,
right?
And it's always the bad recent films.
Exactly. And like, we can do the numbers. It's not that hard to do that, right? And then averages, oh my goodness, I can talk for a long time about average. If someone says average, normally it's the mean. Mm-hmm. But you're right. If it's appropriate to use the median or something else, you should. And things like income and stuff where you don't want it to be swayed by a few outliers, because then you're swayed more one way, because a few big values just drags up the if it's an income or it's in life expectancy, a few one extremes at either end will drag it one way or the other. And so median can be a lot more useful.
Matt Parker is the author of Humble Pie: When Math Goes Wrong in the Real World. Read it from page 314.
Yeah.
Read it all the way. I read it all the way from pages 314 through 0. Zed, thank you, Matt.
My pleasure.
And now the spiel. In the Senate trial and very likely acquittal of Donald J. Trump, we have question time. Watching some of these first days of testimony drag on and on have made me question time, but I guess that's better than Jim Jordan's version of a defense, which made me question sanity and suit jackets. So I sent a question to the desk on behalf of myself and just listeners. And here is that question. Do we need any questions after the very first question that was asked to understand what justifications the Republicans will use to acquit Donald Trump?
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. The short answer to that question is no.
Okay, Adam Schiff. But first, let us hear what the very first question was.
Mr. Chief Justice.
The senator is recognized.
I send a question to the desk on behalf of myself, Senator Murkowski, and Senator Romney.
And then Justice Roberts read the question.
This is a question for the counsel for the president. If President Trump had more than one motive for his alleged conduct, such as the pursuit of personal political advantage, rooting out corruption, and the promotion of national interests, how should the Senate consider more than one motive in its assessment of Article 1?
And that's really all you need to know. Because of course the answer is going to be, aha, yes, multiple motives means that there was some legitimacy to what the president was doing. And if the president acted with some legitimacy, then there is, of course, no reason to remove. White House lawyer Patrick Philbin answered exactly that way and emphasized that the House managers was saying there was absolutely no public interest in the president withholding aid to Ukraine.
They talked a lot about these issues in 2016 election interference because they were saying there's not even a scintilla of any evidence of anything worth looking into there. And that's the standard that they would have to meet, showing that there's no possible public interest and the president couldn't have had any smidgen even of a public interest motive, because they recognize that once you get into a mixed motive situation, it can't possibly be an offense. Because it would be absurd to have the Senate trying to consider, well, was it 48% legitimate interest and 52% personal interest, or was it the other way? Was it 53% and 46%? You can't divide it that way. And that's why they recognize that to have even a remotely coherent theory, the standard they have to set for themselves is establishing there is no possible public interest at all for these investigations. And if there is any possibility, if there is something that shows a possible public interest and the president could have that possible public interest motive, that destroys their case. So once you're into mixed motive land, it's clear that their case fails. There can't possibly be an impeachable offense at all.
So a few things. Philbin did a pretty good job making his point. It's an illogical and untrue point, but it was well said. Later, Alan Dershowitz made the point that, in fact, every political act has something of a personal motive because the politician thinks, oh, this will result in good policy, and I'll get credit for that, and I'll get reelected. That's true. But let's think about it. Let's then add up the argument. If there was any mixture in motive, mixture of public interest and personal interest, then you can't impeach. But remember what Dershowitz said. Every action is at least to some degree in the personal political interest. So then it follows you can pretty much never impeach. If Alan Dershowitz were here, he wouldn't argue with that. He would say, exactly, that's what I've been saying all along. You can't impeach and remove the president over anything he does that's within his authority to do as president. There is no such thing as the president abusing his power. Philbin and the other Trump lawyers made this point in so many ways, that the president's executive powers just should not be checked, that a president is free to defy precedents, is free to establish his own protocols for giving aid, is free to dismiss the warnings of longtime staff, because it is simply impossible to defy an underling. He is the boss of bosses. He has an authority that's impossible to abuse through anything short of the specifically criminal. At one point, Trump lawyer Philbin even said this.
The president cannot defy the agencies within the executive branch that are subordinate to him. It is only they who can defy the president's determinations of policy. And what this all boils down to, really, is it shows that this case is built on a policy difference, and a policy difference where the president is the one who gets to determine policy because he's been elected by the people to do that.
Philbin went on to describe presidential subordinates this way.
Those who are staffers in the executive branch bureaucracy are not elected by the people. They have no accountability, and they have no legitimacy or authority that comes from an election.
Oh, I would have loved a senator to next ask a question to Mr. Philbin. Here is the question. I'll try to do my best John Roberts voice. You said staffers, not elected by the people, have no legitimacy or authority. As a deputy assistant to the president in the Office of White House Counsel, therefore a staffer in the executive branch, do you have no authority and legitimacy? I'd have loved to hear him say yes. But of course, if he did admit it, you can't believe him. What? With no authority and all. I want to return to my main point. My main point is the question of multiple motives. That is exactly how the Republicans who vote to acquit will justify themselves. They will say, well, I think a lot of things were going on, and I don't discount the idea that maybe there was something improper in some of the Joe Biden investigation initiatives. But since some of it was legitimate, that's all you need to know. Acquit. Okay, that's what they'll say. So what is the proper rebuttal? Is it true that if you can prove a mixed motive, a mixture of some legitimate and some political, then we should just default to a finding of not guilty? Adam Schiff offers a key point, and it rests in the precise words. The mixed motives, when we say mixed, should not be understood as a mixture of legitimate and personal or legitimate and political. Here now is the noxious side of that mixture, as properly defined by Schiff.
If any part of the president's motivation was a corrupt motive, if it was a causal factor in the action to freeze the aid or withhold the meeting, that is enough to convict. It would be enough to convict under criminal law.
A corrupt motive. That is the better way to think of it. Otherwise, if a government official took a bribe from a potential contractor, but then claimed, oh, I would have selected that guy anyway, he's the best man for the job, well, then you'd have to vote to acquit that government official. I guess it was partly a legitimate motive, you'd have to say. No. If any part of the motive is corrupt, not self-serving or political, corrupt, then it is all corrupt. Hey, look, I am sure that in a gangrenous limb, you'd have some sinew or bone that's unaffected by gangrene, yet it's still a rotten limb. I suppose in many crimes, there are some elements of the not criminal. Hey, I got my car. I was going to the store to buy some kale, which is healthy. I mean, the fact that I mowed down a pack of Cub Scouts along the way is unfortunate, but since some part of my motive was legitimate to get to this store for that kale, you must acquit. This president abused his office the minute he abused his office. It doesn't matter if you think some of his motive was legitimate. To offer him this carve out, to tell yourself, oh, I can't disprove that 2% of what he was doing or what was going on in his mind was the legitimate, if incorrect, thought that Hunter Biden was really corrupt. It's laughable. It doesn't fit with the facts. It doesn't fit with logic. It's a get out of accountability free card, which is, of course, exactly where the Senate impeachment trial and very likely acquittal of Donald Trump was headed all along. At least we know now what one of the justifications for the gangrenous verdict is going to be. And that's it for today's show. Priscilla Alabi is the Gist's associate producer. If she has even a smattering of a scintilla, of an iota, of a morsel of werewolf within her, I say that's too much werewolf. Daniel Schrader produces The Gist. He doesn't have a whit of a shred, of a crumb, of a soupçon of appetite for this filthy kitchen table. Hey, you know, every podcast host says, go online and leave a review. It'll help our ratings. I don't know if it helps your ratings, but I have a new strategy about this. Don't go to the big one, the Apple Store. Go to podchaser.com. It's good, but there are very few reviews of podcasts out there. So if only a few of you do it, well, you'll be a large percentage of all reviews at podchaser.com. Leave a review if you like the show. The Gist. You know that first decade from 1 to 9, it didn't exist, but it retroactively takes the hit for being a 10-year period with only 9 years? Well, I guess you could say that decade decayed. You could, but as Hillary says of Bernie, no one would like you. Oompa-roo-dap-roo-doo-roo, and thanks for listening.